Hey, this is Continuing with Arthur Covington on 23rd June, 76. So now, when did the daily monitoring program actually begin?
In February, sometime of 1947.
And it has been continuous until, still going, is that true?
Still going, yes. And it's even multiplied to two stations, one in Lake Traverse, Ontario, and the other in Penticton, mm-hmm. British Columbia.
And when did that happen?
The Penticton station occurred in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
The ARO station in 1962. The solar patrol observations were first taken at the radio field station in 47, as I've mentioned. And we were surrounded by radar developments, so that was real nuisance. I can recall running around the radio field station just asking
right.
who'd had various transmitters on. And so in about a year's time, we established Goth Hill Radio Observatory about 5 miles away from the radio field station. And that was, Goth Hill was in existence from 1947 to 1962.
I see.
Goth Hill Observatory, in turn, came polluted with radar interference from the Ottawa Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to the establishment of the Algonquin Radio Observatory, ARO, at Lake Traverse.
I see. And in all these years, how many days do you miss per year, typically?
Oh, at first, we took Saturdays and Sundays off.
Oh, I see.
A matter of convenience.
But it was not automated then, either.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah.
But in about 2 years' time, we began to see the gaps were significant, and then we made arrangements to continue Saturdays and Sundays. But the real program of continuous observations didn't start until the IGY in 1957.
Now, what do you mean by the real program? What was the difference before and after?
Oh, the solar program, I'd just taken as incidental. There was always a need to develop new equipment. And after the Solar Patrol was established, we tried a number of experiments. I can't recall which came first. But one of them was to build a big antenna to get high resolution
mm-hmm.
so that
right.
we could pick out sunspots. Well, we went through various stages. And finally ended up with a slotted waveguide array 150 feet long.
Right.
And that was in operation around 1950 or so.
1950, now, it was first described here in 54, I think, in an article with Covington and Broughton in APJ.
That's right. I guess the construction started in 1950.
Yeah.
Finished in 52 and wrote the paper in 54,
yeah.
So that's a four-year undertaking.
And what was the purpose now? What was your goal to do with this?
Well, this was to study the radio emission from individual radio sunspots.
Right, you had a fan beam, I guess?
Yes, the fan beam, as I recall, was about 8 minutes east-west and 10 degrees north-south.
Mm-hmm.
The slotted waveguide array is probably the longest that's ever been made.
For any purpose.
For any purpose.
Yeah. How did you come upon that? I don't think anyone else in radio astronomy has made a slotted waveguide array either. Is that true? Or?
I think it's not true. I think maybe SWERP has one in India.
Okay, that could be.
And the people at Illinois had one.
Did they? What was that?
Vermilion?
Yeah, what was that used for?
Cosmic noise, the galactic sources.
Really?
What's his name?
Before, Svensson?
Svensson, yes.
Before they got the big dish, the big hole in the
it
ground.
It was, Svensson had a parabolic cylinder
yeah.
in the ground with a line feed along the top. I'm referring to the line feed.
Oh, the line feed, yeah. So that was a feed in that case rather than the actual antenna, yeah.
Well, we're getting into what's an antenna.
Yeah, right, okay. I see. Okay, it was used anyway. Before we get onto that, though, when I was asking about how many days were missed, I meant just due to electronics failure or something like this. I'm just curious as to how perfect the record is of a flux value at 10.7 centimeters on each day.
Well, there came a time when I realized if a service was to be maintained, it would be wise to have duplicate apparatus. So quite early, we duplicated everything that we built. And, of course, it's easier to keep two sets going than one.
Yeah. So do you have any feel, though, for how many? Still, there must be a couple of days that got missed for one reason or another.
Well, after 57, I think the records are pretty continuous.
Hmm.
And the technical staff, of course, worked Saturdays and Sundays, and the arrangements had to be made to compensate them one way or another.
What was the change in the program before and after the IGY? I'm not sure I understand that.
After IGY, the solar radio emission was then really accepted as a measure of solar activity. And we started sending our daily flux values to the World Network.
Oh, yes.
And in North America, the headquarters is centered in Boulder, Colorado.
Right.
And with this sort of a service, outside service, the feeling is, well, somebody depends upon you.
Yes,
so you
take
a slightly different attitude towards your work.
Right.
Prior to that, I know I was more interested in building big antennas and improving receiver quality. And so
you're saying that the monitoring for the 10 years, 47 to 57, was really just something always going on the side, and your main activity was in thinking about building new antennas, high resolution and so forth.
That's right.
I see.
Well, in time, then another factor occurred from about 47 to 56. The National Research Council Observatory was the only one operating in Canada. The Dominion Observatory is the senior observatory with a tremendous, intense tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And they became interested quite seriously in wanting to get into radio astronomy. Then there was some need to cooperate, and it was quite a difficult period. I don't know quite how to describe it.
As to how exactly to bring this about, you mean?
Well, I think in the case of the National Research Council, the long array which we were using was first 150 feet, and then we made it into a compound interferometer by adding two outside dishes, and it was 300 feet.
Right.
And at that stage, there was a question of whether to make a north-south extension or still to go further east-west. Well, at this time, the Dominion Observatory indicated that they wanted to become involved in radio astronomy, and a series of meetings occurred between the two institutions, and it was decided to commence a site survey throughout Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where, in our particular case, Nick Pattinson got together some radio equipment in a lorry, sensitive receivers, and a number of sites were tested.
Now, what year is this now you're talking
this
about?
This is 56, late 56. The actual field observations were made in 57.
Mm-hmm.
The Dominion Observatory under Jack Locke first used the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to Greenbank. It's rather interesting. I think they took the first radio observations at Greenbank with this portable equipment. This was en route to California. Whether or not they stopped off at John Bolton's site at
Owens Valley.
Owens Valley, I don't know. But then they went on to British Columbia, and in British Columbia they, of course, examined in more detail a number of sites.
Now, what was the purpose of going to Greenbank?
If I remember correctly, is Jansky and Bailey had made a site survey for the National Observatory of the United States.
You're right.
and they wanted to use that site to sort of make a comparative measure.
I see, as a calibration. I see. They weren't thinking of putting the Canadian Observatory in Green Bay.
Well, we often joked about that.
So you were not directly involved with
No, I wasn't. That. At that time, I was quite committed in the IGY program. See, this would be 57.
Right.
And IGY was going in full swing. And,
right. And what were you especially doing for the IGY?
Oh, it was making sure that the daily flux measurements were made and sent out on this international network. And then we further introduced the practice of looking at outbursts and describing them in terms of type, and telling when they commence, their peak flux, and mm-hmm. so on.
Now, what do you mean? Well, I should first ask, the daily monitoring, this was a single noontime value, was that?
Oh, the daily monitoring, by this time the equipment had some automatic features, so the antenna would start tracking at sunrise and continue until sunset without any person being present. But the actual determination of the sensitivity required somebody being present.
Mm-hmm. And putting a noise tube on or something?
Or putting the black box on the around the dipole to measure ambient temperature, and then pointing the antenna towards the zenith.
And that black box was used all the way up until the IGY, you're saying?
Yes, and even now the black box has been replaced by a more convenient waveguide termination. Mm-hmm. We call it a flap attenuator. We're using a standard S-band waveguide. That's mm-hmm. 3 inches by 1.5, and there's mm-hmm. a long flap.
I see.
A piece of bakelite covered with carbon mm-hmm. just flips in, and it is now the black box.
Right, I see.
But this has proven very reliable, and I have quoted and still stand by it that the relative accuracies over this period of time, except for the first 6 months, is about 2.5%.
Right, and
more recently, when we've had the two observatories going, that is ARO and DRAO, I'd say the relative accuracy could be 0.5%.
I see. And there was another article in the special issue of the Proceedings of the IRE in 58 with MED, in which you say that the earliest fluxes were good to plus or minus 10%.
Yes.
Perhaps. And when did they become more accurate?
About after 6 months or so.
Once you got your...
Late 47.
Mm-hmm. And what was the measurement at that time? That was not tracking all day long, was it? Or
No, we would come to the lab about 9 o'clock or so, and then we would start the instruments going.
I see. And you take a mean of the entire day's...
Oh, no, the 10-centimeter emission is quite constant compared to the metric wave emission.
Right.
So usually one calibration per day is satisfactory. Of course, we had to test this. I remember spending a week or two taking observations every hour during
right.
the day and seeing that they were pretty constant and realizing one would be sufficient.
The monitoring was only for solar activity then?
Yes.
I mean, the daily tracking was only for activity. Okay, let's just look at some of these papers that haven't been mentioned, projects. Proceedings of the IRE in 49, you say that the quiet sun has no polarization, but sunspots have circular polarization. This was apparently a large quarter wave plate that you put over. Can you tell me about that?
Oh, nothing much other than it's a direct analog taken from optical physics.
But I think that was the first time that anyone in radio astronomy had done that, putting a... I don't know, maybe Wild about that time.
No, I think it could be the first or second. We should look and check and see what Ryle did. As he might have used an interferometer with cross dipoles.
That's what he did, yes.
And I think that came slightly before, but I'd have
oh, yes.
to check.
Oh, yes. He detected the circular polarization before, but I'm thinking of the quarter wave plate over the entire antenna was sort of an unusual thing.
Oh, yes, that would be, I think.
Yeah. No, he had that in 46, right, that circular polarization. And Hay and Appleton also had circular polarization in 46. Yeah. In fact, there's a third paper, I can't remember. That must be the Australian group, that's all that's left. They're all together in Nature within 2 weeks. Okay, now here, Covington and Med in 49 in the Journal of the RASC on simultaneous observations of 8 events at 1.5 meters as well as the 10.7 centimeters. Yeah. Did you set these meter wavelength observations up yourself?
Well, I was curious to see what the metric wavelengths profile looked like in comparison to the 10 centimeter. Actually, having actual observations in my own hands, Wilf Med was the first engineer who was working with me, and mm-hmm. it was one of his first projects. And we looked at those simultaneous profiles, and I know I realized that the entirely different nature indicated that the 10 centimeter emission came from one level and the metric from another.
Yeah.
And there'd be such a wealth of detail in these two regions that it'd be wise for me not to pursue the metric wavelength. So
I see.
More or less bowed out of the metric wavelength.
And decided to stick to microwave. Now, what about this Journal of the RASC in 53, where you talk about the diminution of the 10.7 centimeter flux after a flare in May 51, and you were wondering, according to the abstract, whether the flocculi might be doing some absorbing. Has this phenomenon been confirmed since, or?
Yeah. It's quite a rare event, but it's been confirmed. We've confirmed it. The Japanese confirmed it after us, the Germans, Hackenberg, the Heinrich Hertz Institute confirmed
right.
it. It's relatively rare.
What are the conditions that are necessary, does it seem?
It seems as though the flare occurs. It's a brightening of a certain level, and then later on, some dark clouds are ejected, and they lie over this bright plage, and thereby they're dense, cooler, and thereby they cut off the more intense emission from the underlying area. Just an illustration of the complexity of the flare event.
In other words, the plasma frequency becomes so high as not to let the 10.7 centimeters through?
Yes, that's one way of putting it.
Because I mean, you're talking about the microwave flux goes down, the H alpha flux does not diminish too, does it?
Yes, in the May event, it did diminish.
I see.
And in fact, that's how you can detect that these dark clouds
lie
over the.
When you say dark, you really do mean that also.
They
optically.
Are dark, yes, yeah. In this case.
Now it looks like the first time that you teamed up with some optical astronomers to do some interpretation was in 53 when you gave a talk at the AAS with Dodson and Heydemann, is it?
Yes.
You talked about the percentage of H-alpha events with respect to the percentage of radio events and the flare importance and so forth. Was this the first time that you had collaborated with them?
Yes, it was the first time I had collaborated with optical astronomers of that nature. Helen Dodson and Ruth Heydemann are from the McMath-Hulbert Observatory. Previous to that, they had collaborated with Cornell University. I'm trying to think, Seeger and
Burroughs.
Burroughs. And they'd sort of exhausted that particular study. And then they became aware of our 10 centimeter work, and they discussed the whole possibility of coming to Ottawa with Dr. McMath, and of course got his blessing. Mm-hmm. I was told that he was sort of skeptical of radio astronomy. And as I recall it, he said, make sure those bumps are genuine.
Right, right.
So I think it was in February, Helen and Ruth came. And I recall meeting them at the hotel. They had two suitcases chucked full of optical pictures.
Yeah.
And I took them out to the radio field station and sort of set things down. One of the first questions Helen asked me, what did you see on May the 19th, 1951? Mm. And she had observed this darkening of the H-alpha with a dark cloud lying over the bright plage. And so we looked at the radio records and there was the diminution.
I see.
Up to then, I had been aware of the reduction of the radio waves, but being so unusual, I...
You've been skeptical.
Skeptical. Yeah. I didn't know what to make of it. You see, you just have an isolated event.
And, sure.
I happened to be at the observatory when that was occurring, and fortunately, I checked all the equipment and satisfied myself that everything was normal, and... Mm-hmm. I was willing to stand by it as being a good observation.
Well, I'm interested in this because this is one of the earliest examples of a direct joint collaboration between optical and radio astronomers.
I hadn't realized that.
Well, there wasn't, if you'll think about it, there really wasn't very much because the optical astronomers were very skeptical. They did not understand the radio technology and so forth.
McMath's statement, make sure those bumps are genuine.
Exactly.
That's all he regarded them as bumps.
But apparently, Helen Dodson, anyway, believed that there was, that these were, you know, that this was a very useful science and so forth.
Yes, she was quite helpful, and I appreciate her understanding and the optical side.
Right. But it was her that came to you rather than you did not go out seeking.
That's right. It was through McMath. And I think Helen approached McMath, of course. And there's Moeller is involved in this at the McMath end as well.
You had a NRC report in 55, in which you talk about information that can be derived about atmospheric refraction and absorption from low elevation observations, which I suppose was just something that you decided. Was this a special program, or you just took your...
The background of that is interesting. It goes back to the radar aspect. There's Bill Brown, who was in charge of the radar program, and he saw the radio telescope on top of a building, and I was following the sun. Now, he had the task of calibrating, the bore side of a radar antenna?
Right.
And he decided that he would use the sun. You know, you can get the position of the sun from the almanac.
Right.
And so, I think as early as 47, or it would be a bit later, 48 or 49, he was using the sun to calibrate the bore sight of an MHF, microwave height finder. And it was quite successful. Well, then time went on, a few years, and this was picked up by the Canadian Army. And they wanted to know more about the whole radio phenomena of the setting sun. And in response to their request, I prepared that internal report.
I see. Did this involve special observations, or?
Not particularly.
It was things that you already knew,
It was very practical because the Canadian Air Force was had numerous stations throughout Canada, and they had to check the bore site of all these antennas, and this was about the only convenient and reliable way it could be done. I think now it's a fairly common practice for certain antennas.
Yeah. What about the 1955 eclipse? which you had a paper with Med, Harvey, and Broughton on. Can you tell me the story about that?
Oh, that was more or less prepared. We knew about it well in advance.
Was that in Ottawa?
In Ottawa. Yeah. It was a partial eclipse.
You've never gone on any expeditions to eclipses?
Yes, we did that in 1963, to a place in Quebec, province
right.
of Quebec.
But now, you said that Med was your first engineer. Was the group that working with you growing during this time, or was it always staying?
Oh, I mentioned the exodus of engineers from council into school and the atomic energy
right.
program. Well, I then worked with acquired two technicians, so they were working with me for a while, and then the Med came. It was growing, and then Broughton came. He came first as a summer student, and then
mm-hmm.
later as an engineer. And then Gladys Harvey. We had Zotov, Makov.
Mm-hmm.
But he only stayed a year or two. And by 1954 and 55, we were quite a small group. Four professionals and three or four technicians. Oh, at one time, I guess it's worthwhile to mention, during the Korean affair, Med was assigned to some radar development, and the NRC nearly closed down the radio astronomy.
I see.
I had a stubborn streak and refused to move, and so we hung on.
Uh-huh.
But after that episode, it grew some more.
But there was no other radio astronomy until Penticton got going in Canada, is this correct?
Pretty well. There was a group over in Defense Research Board, Ted Hartz. I'm not quite sure when he started.
What did he do?
He was monitoring the scintillations from Cassiopeia and the absorptions of cosmic noise due to the SID effect.
I see. H-A-R-T-Z?
H-A-R-T-Z.
I don't know his name. And this was about what time was this?
54, 55. Ted Hartz, in the history of radio astronomy, I think, stand out, I should be checked in this. The Canadians have the Alouette satellite, and they took some of the first radio astronomy observations from the satellite.
I see. When was that satellite sent up? Roughly, once again, I get it.
65? I should know.
Yeah. Mid-60s sometime.
Yes,
yeah.
Mid-60.
Okay, I'll check into that.
Yes, I would check that in. It's a significant observation. I remember being at meetings discussing the whole thing, but
we got sidetracked from talking about your proceedings of the IRE in 1948 paper, in which you established the 27-day periodicity.
Yes.
This must have been quite exciting to find this, that the monitoring was really worthwhile and so forth. You know, in terms of showing something. Were you learning a lot about the standard solar astronomy all this time in the process? Or were you just... I'm trying to get at how you went about trying to interpret all of this.
Well, at that period, I remember Pazzi came through, Joe Pazzi came
mm-hmm.
through. I had been trying to place this visit. He said it was 47. Well, I guess we learned our astronomy in a sort of an amateurish way. We were really more interested in the radio technology.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Pazzi, of course, was an ionosphere man.
Yeah.
And he and the Australian groups had pretty well set the theory, and they, as a radio engineer, you sort of pick up these things quickly and you don't worry too much about them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I wasn't too excited about
I see.
The...
Well, what really did turn you on then, as we said?
Oh, the building of a big antenna.
I see.
Getting after high resolution.
But you must have had great dedication, though, to keep this monitoring going. Well, I just mean it's exciting, of course. It's just sort of a service. Is that the way you were looking at it?
Yes, the dedication has come much later. As I said, the Solar Patrol, even in the group, is something you do. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like keeping house, you know. Looking back now, I wish we'd been a little bit more tidier.
You kept our tidier house, yeah, a little bit. Well, could you summarize briefly what you feel, it's been almost 30 years now of monitoring, what that monitoring has mainly shown in terms of solar physics?
Well, one thing I hope and I think will happen is it will provide a very precise measure of solar X-ray ultraviolet emission. And if the technology were pushed a little bit, you could get down to a tenth of a percent.
And accuracy.
Accuracy.
Yeah.
And this is far more than any optical observatory can do,
mm-hmm.
or, well, be a satellite observatory.
Yeah.
And even though it's, some people don't like saying it's the next decimal place, but when you look back over the history of science, the next decimal place is usually...
Many times.
Discovery of argon and...
Right.
So on. Well, the work I've done, I think, is can be summarized in perhaps three areas. The provision of this index, which is pretty well recognized,
mm-hmm.
and I was also puzzled over the burst profiles, as the dynamics of flares, and so...
The which profiles?
The burst profiles.
Burst profiles, yes.
Burst profiles.
Right.
You're bringing back other memories. I can remember spending months looking at these burst profiles and thinking of mechanisms, how regions can decay.
Mm-hmm.
Not very profound, but they intrigued me.
Yeah. I don't think you published very much along these lines, did you?
Well, yes. There was an international symposium in Paris in 1958.
Oh, yes. Right.
And there's a paper in there. That paper was produced under great stress and very quickly. In 2 weeks, I think.
Yeah.
Less than 2 weeks, I produced it. And somebody's referred to it as a classic. I'm surprised.
But in the Journal of the RESC in 58 also, you talk about there are two basic types of flares, thermal and non-thermal.
Yes.
And this must have come from this studying of burst profiles also.
Yes. That intrigued me more than the solar patrol, the patrol nature.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the development of high-resolution antennas, and that led to the compound interferometer.
You haven't told me about actually building the compound interferometer. What?
Oh, I think that would be another stage.
that was in the mid-50s?
54, after 54. In 54, I made a trip to England and the continent. It was to attend the IRSI General Assembly,
mm-hmm.
at The Hague. And there I realized that Lovell's Big Dish was about to be completed,
mm-hmm.
and that if we could do something with our slotted waveguide array and using the strong sun, using the strong source as the sun, then we could probably get some high resolution that Lovell couldn't get.
Right.
So that was part of the realization and the creation of the compound interferometer.
I see. Although he, in fact, never did any solar work with that dish.
No.
Yeah. But you didn't know that at that time, I guess.
I was just more anxious in getting the resolution.
Yeah. What came out of the compound interferometer and its extension? Did this high resolution pay off?
Yes. Well, at the Algonquin Radio Observatory, we now have a 32-element array, which is 600 feet long and produces a fan beam of 1.5 minutes of arc. And we are now taking daily transits of
the
sun.
32 small dishes?
32 dishes in a row.
Mm-hmm. But what about these in the 50s, these compound interferometers? What did they tell you about the nature of the burst and active regions and so forth?
Well, it gave us the equivalent temperature of the sunspot, which more or less verified the eclipse observations.
Yeah.
And the east-west dimensions, a few minutes of arc, and again that more or less verified the eclipse observation. We did notice that on the edge of the, on the limb of the sun, the radio spots were point-like, so this would imply that the emitting surface was a plate-like structure mm-hmm. that lay on the solar mm-hmm. surface.
I noticed that back in 1960, you have a paper in the Bulletin of the Radio Electronic Engineering Division of NRC. Covington, Legg, and Wong proposed an array of 10-foot dishes for Algonquin, which I guess is what you just described.
Yes.
It's grown out of that. This was 1960, however. When did this finally get built?
Well, that was when the idea was conceived, and it was finished in 66.
I see.
So that was a six-year program. There are actually four stages proposed in that antenna, and we only finished two of them. Well, we're running short of manpower and money, so the full potential of the idea is not available.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to realize that the Japanese University of Nagoya, Tanaka, have picked up this idea, and they have really exploited it. The final step is to connect a computer to the antenna and data process the information, taking up various errors and produce a map of the sun.
A daily map of the sun, yeah.
But we have a two-dimensional map of the sun. That would be...
Well, but now, how would this be superior to Bracewell's array? Is this not similar?
It's quite similar. The Japanese are using a T, Bracewell has a cross. The compound interferometer eliminates some of the redundancy and
right.
makes use of, trades that off to gain resolution.
Right.
But when you reduce the, eliminate the redundancy, then you have to use a, desirably use a computer to process the information to have everything absolutely perfect. When there's no redundancy, things have to be perfect.
Right, everything counts, then,
yes.
Yeah, right. Well, one final thing. We haven't talked too much about your work, well, somewhat, about your work relative to other solar work going on, other monitoring programs and so forth. When was the first other additional monitoring program? Was there any until the IGY? Was that the first time? Or?
Yes, I think the IGY brought in many observatories. And after 3 or 4 years, they sort of dropped out and got into other areas of activity. And I guess I was left holding the bag.
But you were the only one before then that was doing microwave monitoring.
Well, the Naval Research Lab commenced 3-centimeter work first. They later extended it to millimeter work.
Right, but they never really monitored.
Yes, they monitored the sun. I can recall intercomparing our 10-centimeter records with their 3-centimeter records.
Mm-hmm.
This was through Fred Haddock.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they never really published anything. It's the case, you know, many institutions have a backlog of
right.
good ideas which have never been published.
I see.
Well, recently, the Air Force in Cambridge...
AFCRL, yeah.
...have picked up the solar monitoring, and they are carrying it to a number of frequencies.
Right. That's quite recent, though, last 5 years or something like that?
65,
I see.
66, I think.
Well, I think that pretty well covers what I want to talk about, unless you can think of some comments that haven't been touched upon.
Oh, I realize looking back now there have been a lot of ramblings, sort of free associations, and any one of these could lead to further interesting stories.
When was the first time that you actually... Well, the first time you talked with the optical astronomers was with Helen Dodson, apparently.
Oh, it would be...
Well, no, after... That's right, when you did that solar eclipse. Yeah, that's right.
Lurie, and then the second time would be Helen Dodson, yes.
Right, but it was even after that, before you were presenting your results to astronomers at astronomers' meetings, you're usually going to IRSI meetings and things like this. Is this?
Well, that's quite true. It's interesting, after the war, the IRSI meeting was, spring IRSI meeting was held in Washington. This would be 47.
Mm-hmm.
And at that meeting, I can recall speaking to Reaper and Jansky.
I see.
Quite a thrill looking back.
Right.
Jansky, of course, at that time was not working in radio astronomy.
Yeah.
He was working on, I think, receivers.
Low noise receivers, yeah.
But he came down to the meeting. He read an abstract and he wanted to see what was going on. Other people I met at that meeting was Hagen, John Hagen,
mm-hmm.
Haddock of... NRL, Alan Shapley of Central Bureau of Propagation.
Mm-hmm.
He was concerned in providing a warning service for radio circuits.
I see.
And there was another person, J.F. Denise, from France.
Right, yes.
And he was theoretically inclined, and I know he picked up my observations and made extensive use of them.
Right, he had a big thesis.
Yes, in fact, I think it would be the first thesis in radio astronomy.
It might well be.
And the people at NRL translated it, I think.
Yes, that's right, I've seen that translation, yes. What, is there any point, though, where you can sort of say, well, at that time I began talking to astronomers more than I did to radio engineers? Does this strike you as a valid question at all, or?
No, I've been pretty well more with radio engineers than astronomers.
Hmm.
The galactic astronomers are way out there.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much. That ends the interview with Arthur Covington on 23rd June, 76, and this is the end of this side of the tape.